Hello and welcome to the Coaching Podcast, coaching for success in sport and business. Your host is Emma Doyle, the energy and high performance under pressure coach who is a world leader in unleashing human potential. Buckle up for this high octane session. Let them have it, coach.
G'day, everybody, and welcome to the Coaching Podcast. It is my pleasure today to interview Carlos Salum, and he is a leadership performance strategist for sports and business. He's the founder of Salum International Resources, and he's worked with Grand Slam champions. He's worked with Formula One racing car drivers, which I just love. Can't wait to talk to you about that. He's a keynote speaker, TEDx presenter, and also the author of The Breakthrough Mindset, The Glass is Full and a Half, which the title I just love. So, mate, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Emma. Nice to be here.
Yes, thank you so much for being here. So my first question, it's a bit of a pattern break question. Do you prefer to sing or to dance?
I prefer to dance. I wouldn't offend anybody with my singing.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I'm going to flip a question that you love to ask of your, I know in previous episodes, I've listened to you talk, and you always ask athletes and business people, what makes you great? So I'm going to flip that question back on you, Carlos, from my opening line and ask you, what makes you great in what you do?
Thank you. It's my curiosity, my passion for understanding. I really want to know what's behind someone's story, someone's way of presenting themselves in the world, or even their aspiration. Why do they want what they want, in service of what? And what would happen if they get it? In addition to, you know, the secret story, you know, the origin of that passion, because I think that when I find something fascinating, that is my entry point to basically any activity, and especially in coaching. So the storytelling aspect of an individual, a company, the evolution of we were at a certain level, we want to get to another level, is where my curiosity is tickled. I deploy all my tools for understanding, and that's where this question gets deeper and deeper.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go there. Tell us the secret sauce in your origin story. I'd love to hear it.
Well, I was born in a family of immigrants from Lebanon and France in Argentina. So it's a cauldron of cultures, and the two sides of the family were very aspirational, and they understood that education was their path forward. So everybody in my family got a university degree against all odds with great effort, and they got to shine in whatever they did. So that was a big imprint for me. But then my generation grew under a dark cloud of 17 years of military dictatorship. So from being trained for aspiration to someone telling you, no, if you don't think like me, you're not going to be able to do this, or forget any other growth other than what's dictated, that created a resistance in me, and I said, no, there has to be another way. So I latched on to entrepreneurs and people who had made their own way. That's why I found Dennis Van der Meer and Dr. Jim Lehrer, and I worked with them through tennis. Although I had studied 6 years of medicine, I'm almost a doctor, but I invested all that suspended knowledge into tennis as a passport to the world and as a tool of good, because the immediacy of teaching someone tennis or unlocking potential in a physical way, in a fun way, had tremendous power. Friendship can evolve, and friendships took me around the world and working with executives and other athletes other than tennis.
Well, thank you for sharing that. What an interesting journey to have. You mentioned having this natural curiosity and wanting to really understand why things work the way they work, and then being told you had to do it a certain way. One of the things around communication that I'm super passionate about is how can we embed more curiosity within coaches rather than just sometimes coach the way that they were coached, or just telling somebody, hey, you should do it this way because that's what worked for me. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that the trigger question, why not, is very important. To ignite the second question, is there's got to be an alternative, or find an alternative on purpose, even if it's not apparent, because then our mind gets into the creative thinking mode. And even if we are not very good at that skill at the beginning, the exercise, like any other skill, like tennis, a language, etc., starts to evolve, especially in conversation with others, peers, or even experts. No, so why not? It's very powerful. And then even if it's established because it has worked always this way, which can also be a killer of creativity, instinctively as a reflex, I suggest that we ask, is there another way? Because then that's why we might even find a competitive advantage that way. We might find that we're looking into a direction that no one has ever looked. So that could be also very beneficial.
Yeah, that's super exciting. And thank you for sharing your insights there. And what about peak performance and flow state? I'm super interested in Formula One racing, driving at such speeds. I've never really interviewed anyone before that's worked with people at that level. I'm super curious to know about that mindset at those high speeds. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but flow state is going to have to become even more important, as well as imagery and visualization. So tell me about your experience with working with these types of people, and tell me about your understanding of flow state for them.
Well, it was very useful to have worked with Dr. Jim Lehrer since 1988, in which I went to Europe on a handshake, and I created his first European speaking tour. Then we went around the world, worked with basically the best tennis generation in America ever. You know, Sampras, Agassi, Seles, Courier, all of them, they got to number one in the world. And then the understanding that there is an ideal performance state, that flow state can be described in very specific words by all these athletes. And Jim had interviewed over 440 athletes. So the coherence, the consistency of the definition was very important, because we looked then underneath the expressions and looked at the science. What's the physiology that creates this? Under which conditions? No? And of course, there is a physical way of accessing it, and there is an emotional and intellectual aspect to it. So, meaning the body is the tool, the pressure of the competition will generate certain responses. So pressure teaches the body to react in a way that will allow the adaptation to happen, and to enter that ideal performance state in which we are not really thinking, we are basically reacting in an instinctive way. But because we train for that, we are reducing the number of options. So it's much easier to operate that way. And emotionally is important because, like I mentioned before with the question, now is there an alternative? We can shift very quickly, very rapidly, from one observation to another in milliseconds, to be able to either change the direction of a shot in tennis or make a move off the steering wheel in milliseconds as well, and with an accident or gain an advantage. To give you a comparison, We know from science that in tennis, we react in 0.5 seconds average at the professional level. Well, my drivers react at 0.2. So it's much faster. Therefore, when you're training a mindset and behaviors and reactions, you need to keep that in mind as the playing field, and then investigate what's the physiology for them that they would call the ideal performance state. And any exercises, any adaptations come after that. No, I always ask, what are you actually doing? Then we look at what can be done better, differently, and more refined, because they have to be ready, let's say, based on the very strict schedule in the Formula Racing. Everything is timed. There are many people around you. You know, they need to carve at least 10 minutes by themselves. Then other rituals come before they enter the car. Then other rituals when they're warming up the car. And then at the start. The start is critical, no?
Yep.
And then during the race, if something shakes them up, in milliseconds, get back into the state. So I would say, you know, other than a fighter pilot or maybe a special forces individual, the drivers in Formula Racing require the most attention to these factors because everything is so fast.
So what could someone from the business world learn from this being in flow state to close the deal? How do you work with businesses with your coaching, you know, leadership coaching, executive coaching, to help them access flow state, and can they access it?
Yes, because if we take the speed away, the pressure remains. So there are four ways in which we react to pressure. One is walking away. I don't need this. I don't want to do it. I want to avoid the pressure. Then we might get angry because we know that is important, but we might be angry at ourselves that we don't have the full capacity to do it. Or we're going to find a way to blame circumstances or other people, trying to protect our self-esteem. As we evolve as competitors or corporate athletes, we might choke at the opportunity because we cannot envision the next step, or the fear is too great, or we overanalyze. But with practice, if we overcome that, if we just take the risk, no, because I consider myself a learner, is not a pass or fail situation, is a yes and opportunity, I might learn to love the challenge, meaning I embrace every challenge as a learning opportunity. Give me more challenges, because the most important way of learning, I will keep score, the boss will keep score, but in a way I'm demonstrating that I use the same athletic principles that are evident to everybody in a sports arena, because again, the body is the tool. I'm training my physiology to adapt and respond in the most productive and desirable way.
Absolutely. So mental rehearsal, do you believe in it?
Yes, it's essential. I tell especially the young drivers, the young tennis players, I'm working with triathletes at world-class level, you win before you win. And the purpose of everything we're doing is you are going to be the best under pressure. That seals the deal, because that takes away any particular belief aspect. I love the sentence that says, I don't need to believe I have experience. So they need to experience it. Okay. And then the body tells them, yes, this is exactly how I need to feel to organize my thoughts and act accordingly. So when they are not feeling it very much, they can act the emotions, and then the thinking
to feel
is
it.
Clarified. So that's how mental rehearsal is so powerful. Probably you and I share maybe this ritual, no? Whenever they hire me to give a keynote and the audience is going to be big, the space is going to be big. I said, I need to be there beforehand because I need to be in the space. I'm going to talk before I talk. They're going to win before they win. You know, I'm going to rehearse everything in my head the way it's going to go. And then I just embody that.
Yep.
You know? I let my physiology be in the same space. You know?
I love the my one of my formulas I've shared on the podcast before is confidence equals time plus experience. And
right.
You just summarized that beautifully. If for me to feel that confidence, it's over time and plus the experiences that I have. And you mentioned there's no risk of failure because you just learn. You either
right,
win,
right.
You win or you learn. Well, sometimes
exactly.
you do both, of course. All right. So in one to a maximum of three words, what do you think makes a great coach?
First word is discernment. The second word is vision. And the third one is leadership. Discernment because it's important, obviously, to analyze what is. We need to diagnose the situation. And it's having really the ability to understand and judge the situation, the people, the context, so we can make a wise decision to help, to contribute. No? So it's the ability to see through the amount of information that comes from the outpour of emotion for an individual or the diverging points of view from a group or the culture of the company. So what is the red thread? You know, what am I being called to do? What is my mission in this particular case? Because that would connect to vision, which is envisioning what can be. I am here to be a thinking partner. I am here to really provide direction, purpose, and motivation towards the desired outcome. I have to be a little bit ahead of the problem so we can design solutions, co-design them in groups. No? So there is a need for alignment towards the vision. The vision has to be compelling. So if the leader of the company or the coach or the athlete are not already there, I have to be there and tell them, look, I'm already on the top of the mountain. I can point to the stepping stones. You're going to be safe. And this is how it's going to happen, right? And finally, leadership is because we need to ignite with positive emotion, and we need to infuse positive emotion in the individual, in the group, so they trust the journey. Yes, they see the stepping stones. Now, step on them one by one. And this declaration that I made, you're going to be safe, it becomes real. I created an equation over all these years. Now that trust is core, is CO to Q to the cube, RE to the cube, because this leadership that a coach provides is communication that leads to cooperation, that leads to commitment, times, reciprocity, that in groups is essential, but also in coach and trainee relationships. So it's not paternalistic. Reciprocity, results and rewards. No? So we're really fostering this collaborative spirit, even in a small group, like Jim Lehrer did so well when we were working together, and this was validated by two universities. The athlete, parent, coach relationship also falls into this category because they have duties and obligations and ways of communicating to break this situation in which the athlete is less and has to listen to these two voices or all this team. Is collaborative. That's a way that we have seen so much success, no?
Mm.
So discernment was very useful in training Gabriella Sabatini and Sergio Bruguera because they were family environments to win the Grand Slams. The vision was essential for Pietro and Enzo Fittipaldi to win championships, working with me with very little time to shift situations, but the vision that we created was totally compelling and it couldn't be embodied again. You know, the physiology was totally into it. And then in leadership, whenever I worked for 25 years in Swiss private banks or recently Morgan Stanley, these companies, the bosses come in and say, next year, we're going to have 150 to 200% growth. That's the mandate. So before the brain explodes, you know, there has to be a pathway. And the pathway has to be done from the individual to the cooperation and conversation with the team so they can focus on that goal.
Yeah, I like it. And trust is really core, as you said, to all of those things. So the glass is full and a half. What if I said to you, come on, Carlos, that's just positive. You know, it's too much. It's over the top. What are you saying? I need to be positive all the time? I'm playing devil's advocate, of course. Share with us a little bit about your book.
No, that's a very fair observation. It's an intentional provocation to get the mind in gear, to do a double take and look at what I mentioned before. Wait, maybe there is an alternative. Maybe there is no plus minus. Maybe there is something that can generate new value. There is a gap. Now the gap has to be filled by the act of thinking possibilities. So I always give examples with something that might seem useless. I take with me a useless object and I ask the question, what's in my pocket? The pocket is a map. There are expectations that certain things are going to fit in the pocket until someone says something funny. That's the mental operation that will lead to the possibilities. Now we went to another plane. That was a breakthrough. So suddenly in a few minutes, I teach him about what is and truth. Yes, truth is okay, but we cannot be creative if we don't allow ourselves permission to play. And only in play, we can make the mental operations, especially in humor, there is a major leap from what is to what can be through the absurd, no? That we can really observe this other plane of there is no judgment, say whatever you want. Then we're going to classify and see through for fit, whatever fits with the situation we're trying to fix, no? Or improve. And that is really what represents breakthrough for an individual, for a group. Is brought down to the reality of using tools in a systematic way, in a formal way, because now it's a process, no? But all this is a system. And if you go through life thinking this way, you know, is there an alternative or that's funny, maybe it could be different. Now we have the opportunity to be better thinkers. No? For me, the definition that I put in the book, also honed through many years of observation, is a peak performer is a flexible, versatile, creative, and situational thinker that always wants to be a better thinker to obtain better results. No? So is the pride to be a better thinker, is the pride to be open to possibilities.
What's the difference between flexibility and versatility?
Flexible is not getting stuck into the glasses half empty or half full, just the truth, just the facts. No, the facts might not reveal the possibilities. Versatile is being very adept to shifting perspectives, points of entry, using humor, being someone who, as a chef or a painter, operates with a full palette, can create with the same ingredients something completely different. The ingredients, as I said, the presentation, the flavor, and the result, the impact is completely different. Is being creative in the sense of being playful with the possibilities without suffering judgment.
It's hard to remove judgment. I think it's the number one thing that holds people back. What do you think?
Yes, really moving away from something, moving towards something, and having to measure the risk by looking at the gap. But I think that's where play, no? Suspending the operation and say, look, on purpose, now we're going to go to this special mental space from 1 to 3 minutes, no? So we don't burn our brains out, and we just explore different possibilities playfully. This can be provoked. This can be provoked with particular games and triggers. I dedicated my life since 1988 when I learned with Dr. Edward de Bono, the creator of lateral thinking. I went specifically to his private island in Venice. Only 10 people were allowed. I knew it was going to be life-changing, and I wanted to understand, you know, my curiosity needed to satisfy its of understanding how some people can shift situations, emotions, and even products by using very specific approaches, no? And that's what he used to teach, and it has been invaluable because it applies to anything. That's why my pride is to try to be always a better thinker, because in addition to how he's expressed, you know, tennis coaching, you know, leadership performance coaching, I write plays, I paint, etc. But it's about the application of these tools.
And having fun while doing them. You have a fantastic smile, Carlos. And I love the learn through play concept, and I love the just bringing laughter into what we do. I'm doing a workshop tomorrow, and with every concept that we're doing, we're adding in learn through play. So even for empathy, we're using water balloons just to really embrace the you know, catching the soft catching and the soft hands, and to open up new insights. And for resilience, we're keeping two balloons in the air, right? So teamwork. And when every time somebody does this, everybody laughs, because it's normally quite funny when the water balloon bursts, and it doesn't really matter because we're thinking about new possibilities. So this has just been a fantastic conversation. So I'll finish with our season six question, which is, what disruptive idea do you have that will change the way we coach in 2030?
Yes, thank you. I think that we need to consider very carefully that artificial intelligence will be everywhere. So I envision the use of AI to create the use of a collective ethical wisdom, the possibility of creating the universal mind, but with an ethical focus. Because if AI is only used to be more productive, make more money, have an advantage, have supremacy over the have-nots, that is not conducive to a holistic use of a tool that can create possibilities, can create new value. It will reduce value, and it will oppress. I'm not trying to be negative. I'm trying to think that how is possible to create wisdom, collective wisdom, in which the ancient cultures and religions have been trying to do for millennia through their teachings. But now there is a possibility of using a tool that if he has the right rails designed from the start, it can distill a collective consciousness about how it's used and what for. Also because he can answer the question, so they can, no?
Or she, so in that he sense, or she.
Right, exactly. So in a way, I want to do this, and I enter in the system, but then there would be a filter that has been agreed by all users that if you're using it this way, it will make sense. And the question would be, how is the world better because I get what I want, or because I create this product, or because I make this decision? Yeah. And there is an appreciation of who benefits the most, who benefits less, how could this be balanced, rebalanced, no? I think there is an opportunity, as far-fetched as this could think, but I'm trying to make an intentional, provocative leap, you know? In which we're going to have the tools, but it's where we point the tools and what we expect to get out of the tools, but for the collective benefit of the universal consciousness, so the divisions that exist can be bridged. And if this is a tool for solutions, there are many more opportunities to use it beyond the existing political, religious, social, and economical factors. No?
Yeah. And it will ultimately help us become better thinkers rather than just
exactly.
Do the thinking for us.
Yes. So instead of coaches being operators or being facilitators, coaches who embrace this direction and maybe participate in the creation of this opportunity by using the tool in this fashion can be the white knights in a way, you know? It can be a leadership aspect of saying, we propose this, you know, specifically.
Yep. Fantastic. Well, it's been a pleasure in considering that you win before you win. Why not? Is there another way? I do have two pages of notes here. The active thinking possibilities with discernment, vision, and leadership, Carlos. Please, everybody, check out salaminternational.com. I'll put everything in the show notes if you'd like more information on how to get hold of a copy of his book. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, and a big shout out to our friend Fernando Segal, who connected us and doing a great job with with his conferences. So I'll put a link in for his next conference that's coming up as well. Thank you, Carlos. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Emma. Great pleasure.
All right. And everybody else, thank you so much for listening.
The Coaching Podcast is sponsored by Transition Coach for Athletes, a global coaching, mentoring, and US college sporting scholarship placement service. The service helps athletes navigate the often challenging world of choosing your best college fit while maximizing sports performance. Visit www.transitioncoachforathletes.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a rating review on your podcast listening device. And don't forget to tell a fellow coach about the show. The ball is in your court to take action and enjoy your coaching.